Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony gets so upset and so angry and then I start and so to withdrawn.
Choke. And I choke.
And then he chokes and I then he's choke. Exploding
Wait, did
on
he get
himself.
Silent?
I'm
did he
so
get silent?
Bad.
Silent. Silent.
Like and he wouldn't speak to you?
He no, starts
he
to walk away from you.
But then he
crosses his legs, and throws
then,
his arms.
And then he undoubtedly feels the pressure I'm heaping upon him. And then he implodes.
Choke.
And then he's not, you know, I'm not angry with you, you know, but you
but
know
he
knows
he is.
It's you.
I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed.
And let me say, it was the worst, but I loved it. And I was like texting Michael the whole time.
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
How about this? This is the second podcast this week in a summer.
Working, man.
Yeah, we didn't do podcasts for years when on radio. We just stopped working right. The entire summer. But as has been suggested to me, I've got to keep the pilot light on. So this is a podcast.
Just got to get away from Walker.
Time. Yeah, well, Bootsy. Yeah, sure. All right, we're at Chatter. We're not open for breakfast this morning. Resuming breakfast in the fall in September when we come back on the corner of Wisconsin Avenue Northwest and Jennifer Street Northwest. Michael Kornheiser is here. Celebrity intern Matt Williamson is here. Gary Braun is here. Nigel's doing the news. And John Heilerman is here. And when he walked in today, I looked and I said, it's about time. And he looked around like, what, am I late? He said to be here at 7:30. So I said, no. I'm so glad to have you in here. And he brought his valet, TJ, who's been shunted to the back, yeah. Which well, is where he belongs.
He's grateful that he's not out on the street.
Yeah, he's not out on the street. So it's so good to have you sitting in here. It makes me very, very happy.
I think about the greatest moments of my life, and this is already in the contention. You know, the first time I was ever in the Oval Office, the time I played St. Andrews, you know, these are things that you remember forever. This is one of these things that I think will be etched in my consciousness until the day I die.
I was very surprised to learn when you told me that you lived in New York. I've always assumed that you lived in Washington, D.C. Very surprised.
Two most common misconceptions about me. One, that I live in Washington, D.C., and two, that I'm a normal height.
Because people look
big. Everybody knows you're big.
Well, you'd be surprised the number of people who come up and say, God, you know, you look a lot. You're a lot taller in real life than you see on TV.
Because when I'm seated.
Yes. They put on television when you're sitting next to anybody who's shorter than you, they put cushions underneath
right,
them.
Right. They make you all level.
To make them all level. Right. People don't know that about TV. Anyway, yeah, I live in New York City. I lived in New York since 2002. So I've been there now 15 years.
So you are about 6'4, 6'5.
6'5.
Do you dunk? Did you dunk as a kid?
I still had some spring.
I could dunk.
Nice.
That must be. I've never been able to dunk. That must be
just
thrilling.
Lower the hoop.
I was able to do it for about 4 years, from about the age of about 15 or 16 until I was about 20.
Right.
And it was.
So you were tall
and
young.
I couldn't do it in a competitive situation. I couldn't do it in a game. But if you let me out on the court freestyle,
right,
like, and just gave me a ball, I could barely palm it, and I could do a one hand. I couldn't do a two hand.
Could you dunk backwards?
Sorry, yeah.
Were you this tall at 15?
Yeah, 16? I topped out. I hit 6'5" at about 15.
Nice.
The ability
reverse
to do
jam
it,
to Tony's
the,
question.
No, the ability right just to be able
not
to get
a 180.
Oh, come on! Like you're telling me that devalues it?
No, but I mean, wouldn't you have liked to?
Yes, there's a lot of things I would have liked.
Throw it down, big man.
A reverse two hand with a full gainer and a twist. I don't know. Yeah. But it was an awesome thing to be able, that feeling of being able to just, even just do it in a non-competitive setting, it was great.
No, I'm happy for
it. It was an awesome, it's again.
Dunking is great.
Now, again, when I think about it again, the great memories, this actually probably tops it, being here with you.
Well, you joke, but you were fairly impressed with the quality of the
setup
here.
I think this place looks great.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that this would be a place I'd want to come for breakfast, although you were talking about
No, the breakfast
that
is pretty good.
Breakfast is good?
Yeah, breakfast is pretty good.
All right. No, but I think this is a great setup you got
here.
Yeah,
it's very
now,
good.
Now, you haven't done a winter here yet, right?
Not yet.
So you will be there. I don't know if people know this. You're in like a glassed-in atrium. You're in a glassed-in atrium here.
Yeah.
So will you be here like when it's snowing?
Yeah.
You're going to be out here. This is going to be the place no matter what.
Well, we hope we have heat at that point.
Well, let's hear that.
Yeah, the heat would be a good thing. If not,
you should hope you have a restaurant at the rate you're going.
But presumably, you're like one of the owners. You can afford. You'll pay the bills, right? So this is this not heated normally?
No. It's we don't know. We've never needed heat. We
have
air conditioning.
You don't know. Okay.
We got in here in May.
I understand.
So I don't know.
Right.
I assume it. I hope so.
I imagine myself coming back here in February and seeing you guys all out here in gloves and
parkas. We'll still do it.
All we know is that this room takes on water.
It has in the past.
Yeah, it's a history of some leaking.
Oh, we'll, that's not good.
No, yeah. But we'll get
sort of seeps in.
We're going to try
and
fix that. Let me thank Tamara and Allison for their birthday wishes. I want to make sure I do that. I thought we would start with the Nats. It was too late for me, and not just for local interest, but because it was Mike Trout and Bryce Harper.
Sure.
That's what I want to get to.
Right.
The Nats beat the Angels last night 4-3, and I'll get to Harper and Trout in a second. Sean Doolittle gave up a run but got the save. He came in and got the save. The Nats have jettisoned
got the hold.
Yeah, the Nats have jettisoned a million terrible things in the bullpen, just thrown them overboard, including saying to Jacob Turner, never darken our door again. He was designated for assignment. Bad news, though, for the Nats last night, David Robertson traded to the Yankees. Like, that's a guy I still think they have to make another deal, and that is bad news. But the larger news and the larger national news was Bryce Harper going to play against Mike Trout, in effect. And it was a fabulous, can you top it? Bryce Harper hits a home run in the top of the first.
Yeah.
And Mike Trout has to watch this. Mike Trout comes up in the bottom of the first and hits one out, and Harper doesn't even look. It goes to left field. Harper doesn't even look. That was, to me, that was Patrick Reed topping Rory McIlroy in the Ryder Cup. That was a fantastic. Now, Harper won the game, and Harper had two hits, and it was fantastic. But that seeing that on replay this morning was very thrilling to me. You watched that live, didn't you?
I just watched the first three innings, and to me, it was over after the first when you saw those two guys going head-to-head. It was the McDonald's, anything you can do, I can do better commercial.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
just
looked. This was two hitters at their best just willing the ball out of the ballpark with their talent and just willingness to take a hack.
They're the two best players in baseball today. Giancarlo Stanton can hit one further than anybody. So can Aaron Judge. These are the two best players. I think that I would rather watch Harper, but I concede that Trout is probably slightly better. What do you think?
I think you're right that
they're the two best position
players in the game. I've just always thought that if I were an owner, something about Trout's attitude, his makeup, his maturity level. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to be hard on Harper. Harper's been a little bit of a little abrasive. Some of the maturity issues.
People hate him.
Well, yes,
players hate him. A lot of players.
Yeah, right. But Trout's like someone. If I were going to build a franchise, and you said you got first pick, this is the guy. I'd pick Trout.
Trout not hateable.
No.
I mean, Harper is hateable.
No,
I mean, love Bryce Harper.
And you know that if you put him on your team and you build a team around him, you're going to be able to build a clubhouse where there's not going to be a bunch of people who are immediately upset about him and are constantly fighting with him, et cetera, et cetera.
So, but my pushback is this. If I'm an owner, I believe that baseball is not just a sport, but entertainment.
Yeah.
And one guy is much more entertaining than the other. Harper is more entertaining. Harper covets being a star. Harper really wants that. Trout, I'm not saying he's diffident because I don't believe that, but it doesn't seem to matter to Trout as much as just performing and winning. And I, as an owner, I would take Harper.
Because he'll sell more tickets and more merchandise?
He'll be more exciting for me. Yeah.
Maybe. I'll tell you, though, I'm from L.A. I don't get a sense that a lot of the people I know in L.A. who are Angels fans are bored by watching Mike Trout go out there and be, the
they
best,
love him, right?
be the best position player in the American
do
League.
Do you think that his star is occluded on any level by the fact that he doesn't play for the Dodgers?
Yeah, sure. I think he'd be a bigger star if he were on the Dodgers. Yeah, for sure. But, you know.
He's five times the player Yasiel Puig is.
Yes.
And Yasiel Puig is a bigger star.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the questions is, though, with a guy like Harper, and I don't even want to focus on to make it just about him, but if you're an owner, you got the upside of, as long as he stays on the right side of the line, you're going to sell more jerseys, you're going to sell more hats, you're going to sell
more t-shirts, right?
But at any given moment,
you got the Suris.
He could be on the other side of the line, right? I mean, he could do something. You could never imagine Trout doing something that would blow him
up.
Well,
I'll say this. No relief pitcher has ever choked Mike Trout.
Right.
And they choked Bryce Harper on national television.
Yeah.
And Trout's probably a better boxer based on what we've seen of Harper.
That may be the case. Now,
Harper, by the way, 4-for-4 last night.
He had a great night. You were not here the other day, and I don't expect you to remember this, but for those of you who were listening, I went to celebrity intern Matt Williamson the other day about tennis, and he motioned me away. He said, no, I have nothing to say. Zero, which is great on a podcast to turn to somebody and have you say. Yeah. But he is a baseball player.
Yeah.
And in his lifetime, what are you, 21? 20, 21?
21.
Okay, so in your lifetime of watching baseball, which is probably the last 13, 14 years of watching baseball seriously. These two guys may be the best players. They may be the best players you'll ever see. Who would you take, Harper or Trout?
I mean, I agree that I think Trout is a more, like, guys like him more than Harper because, you know, he's not Harper.
He's more likable because he's more likable.
I mean, honestly, like you said, like, baseball's entertainment, I would definitely take Harper. Like, I think he's more fun to watch based on how he performs and what he does.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I do, too. Deliberately throws off his helmet.
He's exciting to watch. Yeah, you always know that, like, he's going to do something great, whether it's hitting or something in the field.
I said yesterday on the show that I think I'd rather have Trout. I'd rather watch Harper.
I think that's right.
You know,
Yeah, for sure.
I think I'd rather.
That's why I'm saying there's a really clear distinction about whether you're talking about is the mental exercise here, I'm a GM and I'm building a franchise, or is it I'm a fan, which city do I want to live in if I have to watch baseball 162 games a year? I'll rather watch Harper 162 games a year if I'm just a fan. But that's a different question than if you're building a team.
Let me get to Kirk Cousins, another big story.
How did you pronounce that?
Kirk, K-I-R-K.
I think it's Kurt.
The general manager and president pronounces it Kurt, is deliberately, and then says it's because of his accent, which is ludicrous. It's deliberately demeaning.
Yeah.
It is deliberately demeaning what Bruce Allen does to Kirk Cousins.
Be like me calling you Mr. Tunney.
Yeah, that's right. Or Timmy.
Which I've been thinking about. Mr. Tunney.
Kirk Cousins is not with Mr. ever Tunney signing today. Here being Washington, D.C., he's not going to do it. They offered him, you know, they made a big point of they offered him $53 million. If they franchise him for 2 years, that's $58 million.
Yeah.
He'd be an idiot to sign that contract. Yeah. The contract is garbage compared to what he's going to get, even if they franchise him again. If he has a decent year, of course they'll franchise him again. They ought to trade him right now because he is going to walk. The first chance he gets, he's going to walk. And he can talk about faith all he wants. I'm not getting into that. He's making a great calculation here, betting on himself, realizing that there's no future, that the ownership of this team, and I include Snyder and Allen in everything that I say, they preferred Robert Griffin. They've never particularly liked this guy. And by the way, before you think I get carried away that he's getting screwed, Kirk Cousins, in those games last year when they had a chance to make the playoffs against Carolina and the New York Giants, he came up small. He did not win those games. He was not good at all. So I do think the jury is still out. He may be a guy like Matthew Stafford who passes for a lot of yards and they don't, you know, they don't do anything.
Well, that you can't – I would not argue that fact that he did not post particularly in that Giant game.
He's betting on himself, though, and he's right.
But he is right, and the only risk is really injury. I mean, I have heard some say, well, with Garcon gone and Jackson gone,
he had great receivers.
I don't think what he does this year, assuming health, I don't think it matters. I don't think there's anything he could do that would keep Kyle Shanahan from being interested in him.
Sean McVay.
Well, McVay's got Goff.
Goff can't play.
The departures of the receivers actually helps him in some ways. In terms of the next year contract, because people will say, well, you
know,
he didn't have a great year, but he didn't have anybody to throw to.
You know? My point is, Shanahan, and that's, I mean, come on, we've known where he's going. In fact, we said on this podcast probably over a year ago, I mean, I think I talked to you about that when was it Tom Sewell? Who was the coach they
Tom
fired?
Sewell.
When they fired their coach, right? Kyle Shanahan knows what
Kirk
Cousins
can
do.
And then they fired Chip Kelly.
And he knows
they fire everybody there.
He knows what Cousins can do in his offense, and he's going to get him. And Kirk's going to get a huge deal. And yeah, you're right. They offered him fractionally more, marginally more, less than $1 million more than he would make if they kept him 2 years in a row, if they franchise him again next year.
No, they left him $5 million short of that because they'd have to pay him $34 million next year.
If they franchise him, but the more likely scenario would be they would transition tag him.
Right. So it's around the same amount.
But yeah, he's gone. He's not just going to walk away. He's going to walk away with both middle fingers extended.
That's right.
And I agree with you. I think they should get. I mean, I think
trade him now.
They actually should have traded him at the
draft.
Trade
him right now.
So here's my question. I always get baffled by the various way that the salary restrictions work and the franchising. I don't really understand any of that stuff. But I got to say. What I do see in this case, and Tony, you and I were just talking a second ago about how the Redskins are just horrible as a management and ownership, and they're like the way the Knicks are horrible in the NBA. But the thing I never understand, it happens every once in a while. I'm trying to think of a good example, but I can't right now. But where you see a franchise in the process of making a deal with someone crap all over them. In the process of doing it, and it seems like over the you look at the way they've executed this in the last 24 hours, how do they expect to have a good outcome this season from a quarterback who is rightly going to feel as though he's been crapped all over in the process of getting his deal?
He's
going
to play under protest emotionally.
Yeah. Yes.
They did
how is that in their general manager?
I don't understand. They trashed anonymously their general manager, said he was an alcoholic. And they knew this when they hired him.
They did it to their last quarterback.
Yes,
they did it to their last quarterback on his way out the door. And you know, there's another side to the coin, and that is that there is a base. There's like a political tie in here, but there is a base of diehard Redskin fans who see that statement from the franchise and think, "Who the hell is this guy? They offered him more guaranteed money than anyone has ever gotten at that position."
There are a lot of people who will look at Cousins and say, "He's a bad guy."
When he comes out and has a two pick home game in game four, it's going to be a mess.
See, that's another thing I do not understand. I say this as a diehard sports fan across not all sports, but almost all. I never understand. I don't understand fans who side with ownership ever. It makes no sense to me. Like, I understand being mad at a player.
Sometimes you have good ownership.
No, but I understand. But I understand there's sometimes a player that players can get you mad, and the players you can abandon a player. But in like the notion that there are diehard fans who will like. You know, as a general matter, as a reflex, we'll be like, "Oh yeah, ownership's right about this and this dispute." I don't get that.
Do you think
how can you be on the ownership side?
Do you think there's a large group of people being like, "In Jimmy Dolan, we trust"?
Yeah,
because probably at least two people.
I've never met a single person in New York City who's like that. Not one.
They are there, and there's a lot of them.
Oh yeah, 30%. Yeah. It's the 36% in the polls for all of these things that happen. Yeah. That's the base. 36%.
It's not the same. Also, is it the same base?
I don't know.
If you were another player thinking about playing...
No, you wouldn't want to play here.
You wouldn't want to play
here. No, you wouldn't want to play here. You wouldn't want to play here when you see the president of the team come out and trash the GM and trash the incumbent quarterback. No, you would not want to play.
And call him by the wrong name.
Yeah.
Had they really wanted management, had they really wanted to do what they were trying to do by holding that press conference, they should have offered him $70 million, $72 million guaranteed, because he's still not going to have taken it.
He's not going to stay.
And then they could say, well, at least we made a fair offer, offer. Right, he has no interest in me.
We'll get out of here. Steve Sands will join us when we return. He's over in England for the British Open. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Policy Genius ad. Life insurance, do you have it? If you don't, why not? Too expensive or a hassle? If you don't have life insurance, what would happen financially if something happened to the primary earner? In this case, me. Life insurance is a good idea to protect the ones around you, but where do you go to get the best prices on the best policy with the best service? PolicyGenius.com, the best online life insurance marketplace. The most accurate quotes from the top A-rated life insurance companies. PolicyGenius has placed over $5 billion, that's with a B, $5 billion in life insurance for people like you. $5 billion as Mark Zuckerberg from Tuesday through Thursday. Policy Genius has a very simple, user-friendly website to shop and compare all the top-rated life insurance companies and give you the best options. They have a licensed customer service team to help you find the best policy at the best price. And while you're there, check out their other insurance offerings like pet insurance, which I totally support. Go to PolicyGenius.com today to save over 40% off other prices for life insurance. That's big, 40. I walk in for 40. When life insurers compete for your business, you save money. That is PolicyGenius.com, PolicyGenius.com. Zero jargon, zero sales pressure, zero hassle. Life insurance made easy. Free quotes, zero hassle. You shouldn't say zero hassle again. I mean, you said it once. You know enough.
Right.
Free quotes, peace of mind. Peace of mind is good. Don't wait. Go to PolicyGenius.com today.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Mark Rogers, who writes, "You were nice enough to play my song Swerving in June. Now I'd like to introduce to you my new single, Right Here. I once heard you say that hearing And Your Bird Can Sing made you happy. I couldn't agree more. I think you'll like this tune." Thank you. Mark Rogers, local, right?
Yes.
Local.
Yeah, and a lovely little song.
Yes. Everybody submits lovely songs. We're happy about that. This is the music playing in Steve Sands, who is in Royal Birkdale in Southport, England. I've never been there. Michael has played the course. Where is Southport, England in relation to the rest of England, and what is its history in the Open?
flew into Manchester, and it's about an hour, 15 minutes southwest along the coast, the west coast of England. Probably, I'd say, 4 or 5 hour drive, maybe D.C. to New York.
Right.
From London, northwest of London. And this is the 10th time Royal Birkdale has hosted the Open. It is a fabulous golf course. Everybody loves it. It should be a great week.
Before we called you, Michael said that a lot of the players refer to it as the fairest test in the Rota.
Yep.
Do you have that sense as well?
100%. I mean, you could, if you want to, now guys won't do it, but if you wanted to, you could take driver and try to overpower the golf course if the conditions allow it. But you could also be a tactician. Zach Johnson or Dustin Johnson could win this week. And that's the reason that guys love coming here to Birkdale. It will never fall out of the Rota unless something crazy happens politically or something like that here. They love coming here. Jordan Spieth was telling me this morning that he thinks, other than Muirfield, which hosted in 2013 when Mickelson won, he thinks this is his favorite course in the Rota. It's a great golf course, Tony, and I hope Michael enjoyed it. I played it one time in 2008 after the last time it was here. It's an awesome golf course.
Michael?
I did enjoy it. I'm looking forward to going back over there with you one day.
Don't wait on that.
It's a long drive.
Yeah, that's really
a
tough drive.
Tony, Michael.
Yeah, that's both of you.
Yeah,
Michael was that me or Tony?
That was for both of you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd love to.
So the headline that I saw the other day, because you just mentioned this, you could try to overpower the course. Was it Phil Mickelson, who has tried to overpower almost every course he has ever played in his life, has decided, or at least publicly said, he is not using driver? I took that to mean it was a relatively short course and you didn't have to do it. Is there somehow more danger with driver? And do you agree with him saying, I'm not even taking it in the bag?
No, I think that, you know, look, I talked to some guys who said they might hit driver four times. It's all predicated on the weather, which is the beautiful thing about the Open Championship. And I think that the strategy Phil is taking is a strategy you're going to see a lot. A lot of guys are going to hit long irons and lay up. It's in quotations. I mean, they're still going to hit it out there a long ways. They're going to lay up off the tee to give themselves a chance. And remember, Tony, the last two times the Open has been staged here at Birkdale, over par was the winning score.
Really?
So if you go on history, if you go on history here at Birkdale, and you're a guy like Phil Mickelson, well, guess what? If you shoot 470s this week, it's a par 34, then par 36 on the back nine. If you shoot 470 this week, you might have a chance.
Yeah, Michael said that the first par 5 is number 15. That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. Now, they you know, the members here, they've redone the scoring, just like they do at the U.S. Open with the USGA, because these guys are so good, and they hit it so long that, you know, they've taken a couple of par 5s and made them par 4s on the front side. But it's still, there's not one hole here. Almost every year at the U.S. Open, you know, we talk about this when we're on your show. There's always a hole or two where people look at the USGA and go, you know, what the hell is that? Not this week. At Birkdale, all 18 holes, every player will tell you hit the fair test. Maybe number 9 is a little bit strange, but that's only because of the design of it. It's just such a great place. It really is an awesome, awesome fair test of golf.
So I picked Mickelson on TV yesterday because I had to come up with a name. Was I crazy to pick him? And beyond that, who is his caddy right now?
His caddy is Tim Mickelson, his brother. Used to be the golf coach at Arizona State. He's now the agent for Jon Rahm, the fabulous sensation from Spain who won a couple of weeks ago on the European Tour. And, you know, Phil jokingly told me a few weeks ago when all the things took place with Ian Bones and they're split up and that Tim was going to be his caddy that, hey, I've been carrying Tim for years. It's about time he carries my bag for a little while. So I don't know about the Mickelson pick, Tony. I mean, the last time he won anywhere was that Open we talked about at 2013 in Muirfield.
Yeah.
It's been a long time between drinks of water for Phil. So coming down the stretch, if he's in the mix, it'd be great. It'd be a great story. It'd be great for us on NBC and Golf Channel. But I don't see him lifting the Claret jug for the second time this week.
I don't want to get conspiratorial, but did you say that the guy who is caddying for Phil Mickelson is also the agent for Jon Rahm? Is that not some sort of conflict of interest there?
Well, Phil's a part owner of that agency, along with Steve Loy, who was his coach at Arizona State when he was a great collegiate golfer. Tim went that route, and then his best player was John Rahm. He left Arizona State to be the guy who looks after John Rahm's business affairs in the same company. Conflict of interest in golf is a very tricky thing. It's not as if Tim is going to give Phil a bad yardage to help John win the Open. He benefits more if Phil wins than if John Rahm wins.
John Rahm's a big boy. He's pretty good. He's young and big, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a stud, man. He's a big boy. You're right. I mean, in stature-wise, he's tall. He's not thin.
He's not thin.
He's got a lot of fire. No, he's a big boy. There's no question. If you remember, after we spoke at the match play in Austin, he took Dustin Johnson to the mat that week. Dustin ended up winning, but John took him all the way to the 18th hole in a great match. He is a big-time stud, not even 20 years of age. He's a tremendous player. He's going to be around for a long, long time.
And it looks like he finally has his temper under control as well.
Oh, does he have a bad temper?
Yeah, that's the thing, Michael and Tony. He needs to keep his emotions in check. When he does that, he performs well. He used to get off to a bad start, and that'd be the end of him. He can be a hothead. Not that that's a bad thing. He just has a lot of fire in him. And I think that, as we get older, we mellow a little bit. And I think he understands that being out here on the world's grandest stage, playing week in, week out, being who he is now in the game, and every shot, every move he makes is now on television for the world to see, I think he now has a better understanding of how he needs to act as a professional on and off the golf course. He's a wonderful kid. I mean, really nice, good interview, gives people time, good with the fans. But he gets really mad at himself on the golf course, and that's okay, but you need to harness that anger a little bit and not have it be so flamboyant where it takes away from the greatness that he's providing fans and himself on the golf course.
This is a very natural segue to make if you're talking about the way people deal with fans and the way they behave themselves. I know you love Rory McIlroy. We have talked about McIlroy on air and off air. What is the deal with him now? He can't make a cut. What is going on with him?
I just think that the game has its ebbs and flows like every other sport. And I think right now he's in a little bit of a down period trying to figure it out. I think people will reach to try to figure out the reasons. Did he just got married? Is he still concentrating on golf? It's ridiculous. He's still concentrating on golf. He's been with Erica a long time. One ceremony on a Saturday a few weeks ago is not going to change the way he plays golf. I just think he's in a little bit of a lull, Tony. He's not putting well, and he's not hitting his driver well. And to me, the three best golfers in the world with a driver in hand are Dustin Johnson, Sergio Garcia, and Rory McIlroy. And I would put Rory atop that list when he is sharp. And right now he's not sharp. He missed three cuts in a row.
Yeah.
That's
terrible.
Not good.
No, I mean, Tiger Woods did not do that.
He's the first one to tell you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Tiger wouldn't miss three cuts in his career.
No.
I mean, he missed three in a row. And, he's one of the reasons I love him, Tony, is because he comes out and says, hey, I stink right now, but I'm going to work at it. And he's working on it. It'll be interesting this week to see how he plays, because with driver being taken out of his hands for the most part, that's his go-to. And we're expecting a lot of rain and wind. And for a guy from Northern Ireland, you would think he's great in rain and wind. It's the opposite. He's not good in rain and wind, and there's one reason for that. He grew up as a Tiger guy, and he traveled a lot to the U.S. to play amateur events. So he hits a high ball as opposed to a low piercing ball, which you see a lot over here on this side of the Atlantic. And I would not expect this to be Rory's week at all if the weather forecast holds, because the weather forecast is supposed to get nasty.
Which days?
It's supposed to be windy. It's going to be really windy on Thursday, and then it's supposed to really blow and have rain on Friday. And then there's a better than 50 or 60% chance of rain and wind on Saturday and Sunday. But tomorrow morning, I think you're going to be okay. So if you're playing early on Thursday, it's better than playing late. If you're playing early on Friday, the forecast is really bad, like wind and rain. But I think, you guys tell me, I think being an American, doing this broadcast is fantastic. I mean, I'm going to be sitting in a tower calling golf and then interviewing the players afterwards. I always enjoyed, when I was home watching the Open, when it was nasty.
Sure.
Because you just don't see that very often at home. And I think we're going to get that at least one or two of the 4 days, which I think is fantastic.
No, you got to watch the golfers and very often in the same round, they'll change clothes three or four times, wind suits or rain suits, and then it'll be bright and sunny for an hour. It's the best thing to watch from that regard. In the majors recently, seven straight times in majors, a first-time winner. Is there an explanation for that?
No, not really. I mean, it's just one of those strange things. Now, you've got to look at the names when you look at a stat like that. Sergio Garcia has been everything but a major champion,
right?
You know, in the last, like, 10 or 15 years. So it's not like these guys are coming, you know, out of the woodwork or off the board to go win. So he wins the Masters. Brooks Koepka won the U.S. Open. If you ask anybody in the world of golf, if you name 10 guys who had not yet won a major who you thought could win one very soon, Brooks would have been on that list. He was on the Ryder Cup team late last year, played very well in a big spot like that. So, you know, those stats are a little misleading. It's true. I mean, there's seven straight first-timers, but who are the first-timers? Are they fluke winners, or are they guys who have been building towards that point? I think the last two guys, Brooks way earlier than Sergio, but especially Sergio, has been building to that point to become a major champion.
And Jason Day, who everybody just assumed would. He's one of the seven,
exactly.
Too. So.
Exactly. Just like Sergio, Jason's in the same category. Did he win his first? Yes, yeah, so he's part of the seven, but when you think of Jason Day and Sergio Garcia, you think
they're great
major champions, no question.
Let's get to the important stuff. What are the odds that somebody will yell out Lachizeri at some point in the next few days?
Well, do we count yesterday and today?
But yeah. Oh, what happened yesterday?
Or does it have to be on TV?
Did anyone say it in British?
No, did somebody yell it out yesterday?
Somebody not only yelled it out to me yesterday, but I walked the course. So I like to walk the course forward because that's the player perspective. And then the next day I walked the course backwards because that's the television perspective.
That's Beatrice level right there, Sands. Yeah. That's Beatrice level breakdown.
Yannick! So a guy yelled it to me yesterday, so I stopped, chatted with him, took a picture. It was kind of fun. Cool. And then today I was walking the course, and it wasn't the same guy, but it was on the same exact hole. And it was a different person who yelled, well, geez, I'm telling you what, you guys have fans all over the world, as you should. It's a great show.
That's good. Okay, so the other important thing is the food in England is notoriously terrible.
Hey, wait a minute.
Where are you staying and what are you eating? Did NBC bring in its own chef?
Well, I feel badly for Nigel, and now I know why he only weighs 128 pounds.
Right.
Because the food over here sucks.
Yeah.
All right? There's no way to do it. It's a big condiment week. I put ketchup or barbecue sauce on everything just to make it a little bit better. No offense, Nigel. Sorry.
That's all right.
You know, NBC brings in its own catering for the week whenever we do the Open.
Yeah.
And whenever we do every 4 years the Ryder Cup on international soil.
Yeah.
Just so we're well fed. So had a nice chicken with some sauce today for lunch.
That's good.
You know, some tomato mozzarella salad. It was good. It was very good.
That's good. And are you staying in a nice hotel? Are there nice hotels there?
You know, it doesn't have two robes in it.
Okay. No, man, it's not nice, is it?
Is there enough hot water?
There is enough hot water, but the water pressure is always questionable over here. And it's tight quarters. I mean, Herb Kohler could make a gajillion dollars over here because I've got that stupid hot, cold, two faucet thing.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
So
the shower is your feet. You're knocking everything over because you're so small. They do things very well over here in certain aspects. We've got a big time beat when it comes to sink features and also shower sizes.
When I went over to cover the Open in Sandwich at Royal St. George's, stayed in a house, rented a house, and I was there and Junior was there, and I made sure to take a shower first in the morning because there was never any hot water for Junior for the rest of the day, which made me very happy.
Hold on a second.
So, by the way, okay. I'll get you out of here on this. Do you have any reaction to Kirk Cousins?
Yeah, I'd like Bruce Allen and Daniel Snyder to remove themselves from any part of the franchise that I grew up loving, and they ought to be deported past Lake Trinan in Oakland and go straight to Seoul, South Korea, and get the hell out of D.C.
Put them in Pyongyang.
Both of them. And by the way, can we get the kid's name right?
That was an embarrassment.
That's funny.
I couldn't believe the Redskins left that announcement up on their website. It was
their position is that's how he says
just
Kirk.
His accent.
Right. His accent.
I was so angry with Snyder and Bruce Allen I didn't even text Gary Braun about it. That's how mad I was.
All right, enjoy yourself.
Have a good week, man.
Have a wonderful time. We'll talk to you.
I feel badly for my kids who are never, ever going to see a championship on that franchise. It's just disgusting. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Steve Sands, boys and girls, Golf Channel, NBC. Great friend of the show. We're happy to have him. We will take a break. We will come back with news. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent in by Mike Goggin in Gaithersburg, Maryland, who writes, Dr. Tony, H-O-F. And I'm Hoff and Woff.
Yes, Hoff and Woff.
Hoff and Woff at the same time. Attached are some fun songs from my friend Caroline Park, a Stanford grad and lawyer at the National Oceanographic. How do you pronounce that?
Oceanographic?
Something like that. And Atmospheric Administration, where fisheries are her specialty, who more than dabbles in music on the side. Enjoy her materials attached, and happy summer, Grandpa.
Noah is how I pronounce that.
Noah, yeah. Oceanographic?
Yes, I believe so.
Somehow I think I'm mispronouncing it. Eileen, you want to take a
shot?
That's right.
Oceanographic?
Yeah, that's good. Michael, when people send in music, and you can listen at the end of the podcast, you listen to the full range of the music. How do they do that?
As always, they can email it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com.
And how are we coming on the chatter t-shirts?
I'm going to be honest with you. I sort of dropped the ball on that in the last week and a half, but I will get on it this afternoon.
How's Bootsy?
Bootsy's great. He has discovered something, though, which is...
Cockies?
Well, no, luckily, no car keys yet. But he's figured out that after you put him in a nice new onesie, that's the perfect time to spit up on said onesie
right.
and all of the sheets in the middle of the night.
Get to work, Dad.
Yeah, so right. Now we just have trash cans filled with OxyClean in the basement. I feel like I'm cooking up something inappropriate for the little kid, just trying to keep him clean.
It's a Walter White thing.
Yeah, very non-Trumpian, by the way he owned the show. He didn't say, I'm not going to own it. The Republicans aren't going to own it. He completely owned it. Just said, sorry, dropped the ball on the shirts.
Well, that's great. He's also owned the fact that the deer eat my tomatoes every single time there's a tomato bud because we don't have netting.
My tomato plants on the porch are now over 4.5 feet high.
Yeah. Nice. If you guys need to get these t-shirts made up, you could ask Ducklow to do it. TJ, he'll go out and get it. He'll have t-shirts back for you by noon.
TJ, can you make t-shirts in return for your strawberry licorice? By the way.
I look at his watch licorice. To make sure he can do it by noon.
Nigel?
So, yes.
Nigel, what did we get?
When we arrived in the studio this morning, there was another package. Open it up, and it's even more licorice.
Black
the
licorice,
Daryl
which
and
I like.
Lee licorice? Yeah, yes. I really like the black licorice.
Hold on, and we've got to get the company right. It's Daryl Lee, right?
Yeah.
Daryl Lee.
Yeah.
And this is
established in 1927, Australia's Daryl Lee.
And the reason we know this is because it's actually from the company. This
What's
is not
the
from little. This is from Megan Trice, and it reads as follows. Dear Mr. Kornheiser, we're excited to hear you and your team love our licorice as much as we do. We wanted to share a few of our favorites with you. Don't worry, it's enough for the whole team to share.
I'm just black licorice or brown
Crikey.
Licorice. I don't like
Crikey.
Any of the others. But
now, that's a knife.
That's fabulous.
That's not,
do you
that's
have,
not nice.
Do you have some news?
I do indeed.
Another shrimp on the bottom.
But that was a really good Australian accent.
Yeah, for an Englishman.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes,
because, you know, the English hate the Australians.
Yeah, because they're convicts.
Well, a lot of
them. They were convicts.
I don't hate the Australians, nor do I hate the Americans, you know.
My experience living in London was the British all hated the Australians because the Australians had better teeth.
Wait.
Well, everyone has better teeth than we do.
Well, I know. Well, that's why you hate everyone.
Hold it. You grew up in L.A.
Yeah.
You live in New York. Yeah. You just said my experience living in London.
I lived in London for a period of time.
What? How long?
3.5 years.
What were you doing in London?
Working for The Economist magazine.
Wow.
When I first started out in the magazine business in 1990.
Did you enjoy
94.
London?
I loved living abroad, and that was like the worst 4 years. And it was like between Thatcher and Blair, right? So it was the major administration. And the whole time I was there, the country was in recession. And Britain has a lot of problems, but they're all exacerbated by everybody being like grim and depressed and unhappy about the state of the economy. So it was I loved it, but I was done at the end of my 3 years there. I was like, I'm ready to go home.
You've lived in a lot of really good places.
L.A., Chicago, Boston, Washington, New York, San Francisco,
nice.
And London.
That
are
is
you
a
ever,
murderous
are,
row.
Do you ever leave because you can't pay the rent and you're on the lam? I mean, these are great places you've lived in.
Number one, I'm pretty much on the lam all the time.
Most of them were left
under duress. Except for the period of some time when I've been incarcerated.
Yeah.
But no, they were, I mean, you know, journalism... you know, journalists move around a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it happens. So I liked all those places in different ways. But some of them when I finished, I was ready to leave. San Francisco is another good example of that. I was like, at the end of, I was in Silicon Valley for a cycle of boom and bust. And at the end of one boom and one bust, I was like, got up.
Do you know who I see on television all the time, who I used to work with at the Washington Post, who is out there now? Kara Swisher.
All the time. Very
Kara Swisher apparently is the go-to person for anything that happens in technology in the United States of America. And I used to work with her at the Post, and she's carved out a fantastic career for herself.
She established a great, first of all, great person, great reporter, and she did this thing that a lot of journalists, she was early in understanding that if you wanted to really have a big voice, you needed to have a personal brand. And in technology, where the industry had been dominated for a long time by trade publications, when she got out there, around the same time I moved there actually, she started writing about technology for the Journal. She was very focused on, I am going to be a figure here.
Good for her.
And then she started the conference with Walt Mossberg, the technology reviewer for the Journal. And that conference made her a lot of money, for one thing, but also made her, kind of a doyen of the industry. And, she is, you're right. If you're booking a cable show now, a cable news
Kara
show,
Swisher.
And you got to think about who am I going to put on to talk about technology, you call Kara Swisher, get her on TV.
How's the news going so far?
I think it's one of my best newscasts ever.
Okay.
I want to start off, we do not do this often,
I just interrupt for one thing to just make sure that people understand?
Technically, he's not interrupting. He hasn't started yet.
I need an arborist. I said this the other day. I need an arborist. The tree
you said the call out
in
no
front of the
responded?
Little house is gasping and dying. It's dying. It's throwing off its own bark. It's in the throes of death. And I need someone to come there.
Similar to how a human
and hold its
will
hand.
Shed its own skin before death.
It's just awful. I need an arborist.
I'm
ahead.
Surprised that you I made a it. Shout out. And maybe when we get to mailbag. We'll
Did you just
some
say
next.
Humans shed their own skin before death?
Isn't that right?
I never heard that. Snakes, I know, shed their skin. But you're saying, is that what I have to look forward
well,
to
Tony,
on my deathbed?
Tony said his tree is shedding its bark
shedding
in anticipation
its bark.
Of its
it's
death.
Awful.
I just figured they're
it's
both,
in the death
both living things.
It makes me very sad to see this because the tree is trying to say, I'm dying here. Some terrible service killed me, and I'm dying right in front of you. Go ahead.
The giving tree.
We don't often, if ever, lead with the weather on this show during the summertime.
The ring of fire.
Yes. I just want to, we're going to have about some of the hottest days that we'll have this entire summer over the next few days. The GFS.
And I'm elderly, officially.
Well,
I could
that's
die.
That's why we, this is a public
come check
service.
On me.
If you're an elderly person at home, it's particularly in the 2015.
Air quality orange?
Yes. It was already
no
an orange alert. An orange alert went out before, I think I even left the house this morning.
It's
this
a double
what,
orange.
This is what the GFS says. 95 today, 97 tomorrow, 102 Friday, 100 Saturday, 100 Sunday, 99 on Monday.
And that's just in Washington. 102? It's hot all over.
But it'll only be 70% humidity, right?
So don't go.
Probably maybe about 85, 90%.
I will tell
bad.
You that anybody who goes out to play golf this weekend in the Washington or in many areas of this country, the middle section of this country is going to be St. Louis, Kansas City, going to be even hotter than this. Yeah. You go out and play golf and you walk. You're suicidal. You're crazy. You cannot do it. You shouldn't even play.
I'd say you should just don't
stay
play.
Home. Stay home.
The right. cart's not going to help you that much.
No,
in that kind of
it'll
heat.
Create a small breeze, but you got to get out of the cart at some point.
Sad story in Minneapolis, Mr. Tony. Justine Damon of Australia, age 40, heard a disturbance, what she thought was a sexual assault going on outside her apartment in the alley, so she called 911.
And got shot.
When police showed up 20 minutes later, she went down
she
in her pajamas.
Walks out to the police
with
car
a phone in her
shot.
Hand. She goes to the driver's side door and talks through the window to that police officer. The police officer in the passenger seat then proceeds to shoot her through the stomach, and she's dead. They did not have their body cameras on, nor was the camera for the squad car turned on until after the shooting. They don't know, people don't know why. But this is obviously creating a lot of questions.
Mayor of Minneapolis said, all your questions are all my questions. All my questions. This is terrible.
Man.
That's just terrible. It's very, in terms of public relations is too pejorative a term. But in terms of relationships between the police and the communities that they serve all across America, it gets worse. Nobody means for it to get worse, but you look around and you go, can I trust this? Right. What's going on here? So it's very bad.
Colin Kaepernick still without a job. Michael Vick was on Fox Sports the other day. And
talking to Jason Whitlock.
Yes, and had the
follow-up. We love Jason Whitlock.
We do love Whitlock.
Love
yes,
Jason
absolutely.
Whitlock.
And here's what Vick had to say as advice for Kaepernick, as how he might
you know, help himself out to get a job. The first thing we've got to get Colin to do is cut his hair. Listen, I'm not here trying to be politically correct, but if he puts cornrows in there, I don't think he should represent himself in that way in terms of just the hairstyle. Just go clean cut. You know, why not? You're already dealing with a lot of controversy surrounding this issue. The most important thing that he needs to do is just to try and be presentable.
Then, okay, wait.
Okay.
Just hold on, just right there, because we have a journalist here. We have John Heilman here. That is the part of the conversation that got picked up. The other parts of the conversation in which he said one of the reasons he may not have a job is because his performance level has been bad the last couple of years. And Michael Vick also said, I'm totally in solidarity with him with what he did in terms of his political stance with the national anthem. But nobody's talking about those things. They're just talking about cut your hair, because then Colin Kaepernick is able to come back and talk about the Stockholm syndrome and make it look like Michael Vick is just kowtowing to the man. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, racial undercurrent in this whole thing. And it gets blown up. And I'm not going to say it gets blown up out of proportion, because these are big guys. I don't think it's out of proportion. But what I do think is the most inflammatory thing then becomes the cowbell for everything else that goes on.
Yeah, well, but that's, you know, I mean, look, for better or worse, that is the media universe in which we now live, right? I mean, that happens, whether it's sports, politics, anything else. That's just how we roll now. But look, there's a lot of things to say about this. What would you like to ask?
Well, I'm going to say that I was talking with Wilbon, and I did this on the air yesterday.
Yeah.
And he has an opinion that Colin Kaepernick is, in his mind, clearly being blackballed by the NFL, which may very well be true if he doesn't get picked up at all.
Yeah.
My opinion was not to that point. It was that there's no longer nuance in the Colin Kaepernick circumstance. You are either with him, and if you are with him, some people see you as un-American. If you are against him, some people see you as a bigot. There's no discussion.
Totally
there's
agree.
No discussion.
Totally agree. It's like it's a litmus test now, and what you're not only what you say on anything related to Colin Kaepernick, depending on where you sit, people read an extraordinary amount into you on the basis of something on the whatever the, you know, even if you say he's not a very good quarterback, which he's not, people immediately like, oh, you're a racist. It's like, well, I'm really not. He's actually not a good quarterback, even though I agree, I'm all for everything else about
it. So I find myself wishing to stay away from this topic because there's no nuance.
But here's the thing. I'll say something with total absence of nuance, but that I think is my first reaction to this, which is I think Michael Vick is basically on permanent probation from criticizing anybody about anything. And I forget about the racial overtones and all the other stuff about this. I just think Michael Vick should basically be, for the rest of his life, given his history, he should be like basically, you know, trying to say nice, productive, positive things about people, because he's not really in a position to sit in judgment of anyone on anything.
Well, it wasn't unsolicited, in fairness.
Except for simply like the questions of, are you a good quarterback? If he had made an argument about Kaepernick as being a subpar quarterback, I'm like, Michael Vick can say whatever he wants about football. But about other things, he should probably just keep it to himself.
My sense of Michael Vick is only...
Dog killer, is my point.
I understand. And he went to jail.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Colin Kaepernick has committed no crime.
Yeah.
No crime. He has not. He has exercised his political rights in a forum where you are encouraged... You should be encouraged to do these things. Michael Vick's life is informed by going to jail. So Michael Vick had to remake himself... utterly.
Yes.
I'm not sure that Colin Kaepernick has to. Now, I like Michael Vick for what he has done post-jail.
Sure.
But everything he says is looked at in that prism.
Yeah.
It is.
I was a little confused by his qualifier when he said, I'm not here to be politically correct, but
he immediately was politically correct. Yes.
Well, like, he probably doesn't see that as politically. He probably sees that as the way back in.
It's sort of like generally if you say, again, to go to a reference that you guys will understand, it's usually when you say, with all due respect, you're about to show disrespect.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I don't want to be politically correct, but I'm about to be politically correct.
Well,
it's
he was politically incorrect.
What else you got?
Well, do you have anything else?
Yes.
Got any animal stories?
Well, I've got a story about a robot and a story about a deer and a dog. What would you like?
Well,
they both sound very compelling.
Well, a robot's an animal.
Yeah,
what's your robot story?
Well, it's Melancholy Happy Trails for Steve the Robot. I don't know if you were aware of this. Steve the Robot was a security robot down at the Georgetown waterfront, right by the Harbor Apartments. And his task was to, after hours, just roam around and make sure the people weren't up to any, you know, up to no good. Unfortunately,
did he end up in the river?
Well, he wandered too close to one of the fountains. And we don't know if... it was an accident or there was
suicide.
Can't
you put him in a big bag of rice?
Suicide.
Can't you do that?
Robicide.
Yes, he is gone, and there are all these spontaneous displays of affection from his coworkers. There are people who have left
like robots. Other robots
gone, but not forgotten.
An old Atari.
Box of tissues, photos of people posing with Steve in happier times. So the company, Nightscope, a Silicon Valley startup that made the robot, says it was an isolated incident, but we will deliver a new robot, a better Steve. A better Steve.
Don't they have cameras on Steve so they can know if someone like picked him up and
threw
him in?
Well, I think they've got to go back and sort of dissect.
Find the black box.
Robot deer, you know, depressed.
A robot dog.
Yes. Yeah. So there you go.
All right, what about the deer and the dog?
Yeah. That's in Long Island.
Where? I'm from Long Island.
South Shore?
It does not say. It just says
South Shore, close in.
It says off the coast of
Lynbrook?
Long Island. It does not say exactly where, yes.
Well, it could be Jones Beach, could be Atlantic Beach, could be Long Beach.
A bloke was walking his dog, Storm, the Golden Retriever.
I saw this.
When there was a little deer, about 3-month-old deer, paddling and trying to get in, but was having a difficult time. So Storm, the Golden Retriever.
Why was a deer in the ocean?
Well, they can swim.
Deer can swim and have been spotted miles offshore.
Yes. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Well, they do. That still begs the question. I mean,
why?
I understand that deer, like the deer, I did not know that, but it also.
Could have been a Chinese deer trying to get home.
I imagine deer might swim ponds and lakes and
it
stuff.
It might have been confused or scared and just ran into the water and then was like, well, this was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Which apparently was because it was having difficulty getting back to the shore. So Storm, the Golden Retriever, plunges into the water.
Dogs can swim.
Right. And goes straight for the deer. And the owner, this guy, Mark Freely, is like, oh, he's on video. He's videoing. He's like, oh, I think he's trying to save it. Sure enough, Storm grabs the deer, drags her back to the shore, brings it in. The deer is sort of, you know, non-responsive. Right. And Storm nudging her, trying to get in front of the deer, jumps up completely out of it.
And then goes and eats my tomatoes.
No. And then sadly, right back into the water and swims straight away. So then by this point, somebody from like Animal Rescue was there. And then that bloke, because Storm was like, look, I've done it once, mate. I'm not going in twice.
Right.
So then this other bloke comes out there. The good news is the deer is safe. And is recovering nicely.
So I think we have an explanation for how the deer got into the ocean. This deer that got back into the ocean is obviously really stupid.
And wants to swim.
Dumb deer.
They probably closed the pool where the deer usually swims.
Deer was talking to Steve the robot.
Yes. Fantastic. Well, that's great. It's great for the. Oh, I'm seeing video of it now. Okay, we're good. So let's get out of here, and we will come back. We'll do old guy, and we'll talk to Heilemann about game change and politics and Trump. And apparently the second Putin meeting. Everybody's going insane about the second Putin meeting. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Casper ad. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep service was developed in-house. It has a sleek design. It's delivered in a small, sized box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. A mattress is for dogs, too. Chessie loves her.
Yeah, she loves her.
The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper's revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature through the night. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. It's a long time, 100 nights. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up. They'll refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. I wish. I mean, I don't get it. The Casper mattress has over 30,000 global reviews. For example, Joseph G. from Colorado, probably related to Kenny G.,
right,
says, as a former athlete, sleep and comfort is key to performance, and Casper does that now for my life and my wife. Dozens of pro basketball, baseball, and football players sleep on Casper. They rave about it. Skip the typical mattress shopping games. Buy the Casper. It's so much easier. You order online. It's delivered to your door in a compact box. There's free shipping, free returns. It's available in the United States, Canada, now the United Kingdom. Don't sit out on the sidelines. Try the Casper for 100 nights in your own home. And there's a special offer to listeners of this particular show, the Great Tony Kornheiser Podcast. You get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/Tony and using Tony. Click on Tony. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Old guy radio for the day. This is the Eagles' first big hit, I think.
That's right.
Take it easy. This is written by Jackson Browne, I believe.
Yes.
Who lived in the apartment underneath Don Henley and Glenn Frey.
Started by Jackson Browne, and then he was stuck on lyrics. Stand on a corner, Winslow, Arizona, such a fine sight to see. And then he says, Glenn, can you help me out with this? And immediately comes up with the...
It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford.
Immediately comes up with that, and then Jackson's
like...
Because
they're geniuses. That's how it works.
Well, you can have the song then.
Paul McCartney and John Lennon write songs in 35 seconds because they are geniuses. Bernie Ledden, an original member
of the Eagles.
Like you,
cranking out a Calumet.
Yeah, 70 years old today. So Bernie Ledden, 70. Glenn Frey passed away. Randy Meisner, in exile, still worried that Glenn Frey will come back from the grave and beat his brains out. And Don Henley, I assume, is in Texas.
Yes.
I assume.
Who was it that did that incredible Eagles doc a couple years ago?
Fantastic. I've seen it 4,000 times.
I mean, I'm not even that big an Eagles fan, but that documentary was incredible.
It's really good.
Just incredible.
Glenn Frey was the executive producer and always looked good in it.
Even
when he looked bad.
Have you seen the Defiant ones yet?
Have not.
You got to watch that.
I've watched a little bit of that. The first is great.
The first three episodes, this is the HBO thing on Dr. Dre and what's his name?
I'm forgetting his name as well.
Come on.
I can't help you.
I'm just having a brain fart about it.
It's okay.
Jimmy Iovine. The first three episodes are incredible. The fourth one's like a little bit of a commercial for Apple products.
This is a documentary.
Yes, it's four episodes about those two guys and who eventually come together, obviously around Beats and the sale of the headphones to Apples. But they're as these two dominant figures for 20 years in the American music industry, and they obviously came back before Beats. Actually, they came together because Dre was on Interscope, but. They have such incredible access to have made it. It's a little soft pedaled in a couple places, but the first three episodes are unbelievable.
I will watch this.
Yeah, it's
HBO.
I
get HBO.
Yeah,
I pay for HBO.
Incredibly strong.
I like HBO.
Gotta watch it.
The History of the Eagles, by the way, was produced by Alex Gibney and directed by Allison Elwood.
Yes. Just fantastic.
That's also amazing.
All right, so we have Heilemann here, and I've spoken of him many, many times, and my reverence for the book that he and Mark Halperin wrote, which is Game Change, I don't know that we've ever talked about this. The most interesting thing to me about that is the movie that got made on HBO is all about Sarah Palin, and Sarah Palin is not introduced in the book till, you know, two-thirds of the book is done, right?
She was not part of the campaign.
She was late to the party.
She was not part of the campaign until August of that year. We weren't chronologically.
I guess I wondered... When they came to you, because you're going to take the money, you'd be crazy not to take the money. I'd take the money. But when they said, this is our idea, did you ever say, what? I didn't see that coming because...
Not for a moment. And I'll tell you why. I mean, well, we had thought that the movie... We had done the deal with HBO to make a movie version of the book even before we wrote the book. And so for a period of time, we thought that the movie was going to be the Clinton-Obama battle to win the Democratic nomination.
Yeah.
And it turns out one of the things you learn about movie making when you've been involved in making a movie is that they immediately looked at that and said, that's a miniseries. It's like you can't do in 2 hours Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama. The Palin thing was two chapters of the book. And it turns out that two chapters of a book is all you really need
to make
an entire movie, because 2 hours is no time whatsoever, right? There are great things in the book about Palin that didn't make the movie because there wasn't time for it. And the key thing about this whole experience is, you know, it's almost impossible to get a movie made. Just in general, right? Lots of great ideas, lots of great scripts, a lot of people and things in turnaround for years and years. When someone like Jay Roach, who directed the movie, who had done Recount for HBO at that point.
Which is very good.
When Jay had wanted to make a movie about Palin, and he had this idea, and when the book came out and he found out that HBO had the rights to it, he went to them and said, I want to make this. And when a powerful director goes to someone like HBO or Showtime or just in general, having a powerful director attached to something increases the odds of it getting made by a lot. And so when Jay said, this is the movie I want to make, we were like, just make a movie. This means that there's a chance this will actually get made. And so we were thrilled. Just said, great, fantastic.
So you didn't feel demeaned, cheapened, any word like that? You didn't feel that all of this work that we did on the the broad outlines and the small strokes of this entire campaign, and now it's going to be about her? You didn't feel like, what are you guys doing?
I think Jay had a really compelling argument for why he thought she was an amazing story.
Well,
and we agreed. We thought, you know, I think you could have made a movie about John Edwards. In fact, I'm still would like to see someone make a movie of the John Edwards story. And again, incredible story. And I think someone will probably at some point make the Clinton-Obama movie. But, you know...
You have Obama elected, which from a historical perspective is enormously important, and it's not in the movie.
Right. I totally agree. And yet, you know, the reality is it's 2 hours, and if there's an artist whose passion is attracted to a certain story, and he was particularly attracted not to the two things that were key in that movie, one of which was the notion of a person plucked from obscurity and dropped into the cauldron of a presidential campaign. Incredibly compelling. She's there for 60 days. What happened? And the story of the advisors, and particularly Steve Schmidt, and the moral thing of I did this, and then coming to the reckoning, a moral reckoning with that, and ultimately regretting having done it. Those two elements were like, I get that. That's a pretty compelling story. Like, I understood that. And what Jay really focused on, and Danny Strong, who wrote the script, the guy who eventually went on to create Empire and has made a bunch of other movies, they were both 60 days is a movie. It's like you need that tight narrative. It's much harder to do something that is trying to capture 2 years or 9 months.
Were you at the filming at any point?
Yeah.
All the time?
Well, not all the time, but now and then.
When you saw the finished product, how did you feel?
Oh, we thought it was incredible. And you know, when they first told us, we were involved.
Did you get on the red carpet? Did you wear a tuxedo?
We went to all the – we went to the Emmys. We went to the Golden Globes. We went to – we got to be – it was a really fun experience, but I will say – you know, we went to the table read. We worked with Danny. Danny was great. They were all great with us. And a lot of people have horrible stories about their experience with Hollywood. Those guys were very committed to the notion that they wanted to make the movie as true to the history as possible. And that would not only be a good thing in and of itself, but also is a important defense because they knew they'd get attacked for making the movie. And if you could say, we based it on this book. No one's refuted anything in the book.
Yeah.
What's in the movie is true.
Yeah.
That's a great defense strategy when Sarah Palin inevitably attacks you or other conservatives who were going to attack the movie. So we went to the table read. Danny's script was great. And you sat around with Ed Harris and Julianne Moore and Woody Harrelson and watched them sit in a room and do the first read of the script. And it was like, this is great. Like, what could be better than this? Those are great artists, great people. Reading
and you're
a great
in there.
Script.
You're sitting
and
there.
And you're sitting there. And Ed Harris stood up at the beginning of the table read and said, I think I should speak for all of us and say we want to thank John and Mark for producing this source material
that is made
for such a great movie. So, again, along with being on this show, a peak moment in my life.
Well,
I'm not kidding.
Okay. And those are some unexpected. I'll go back to this story last week when I got to walk out on a major league field and heard a smattering of applause. That was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fantastic. So, and you don't expect these things
to happen. Right.
All right, so let me bring this up to date.
Yep.
Because you're doing another book, right? You're doing another Game Change book.
The third one, yeah.
Okay.
We did 2008.
And that guy with the scarves, is he going to be on TV with you again? What's that guy's name?
Mark McKinnon?
Yeah, I like that guy.
I think the circus will be back.
I like that
I think
guy.
The circus will probably be back in 2018 once we get done with this book.
All right, so you're a big star now. So where are we now? Now we've elected this president. We've elected Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And he rode in on a variety of things, but one of the things was change. One of the things was, I'm going to be an agent of change.
Right.
Nobody has ever been elected who is like me before,
right.
So give me a chance, and now let's see what happens. What's happening?
Nothing. Good. look, I mean, we have seen, yesterday was a monumental day in some ways. I mean, historically, we can talk about Trump and Putin and the Russia story, which could be, and I've said this on your show before, this podcast before, is the existential crisis that could ultimately be an extinction event for this administration. Could be. So, but that's a big story, the Putin thing. But in the long arc of history, what I now believe, and I've always thought that the Republicans would never be able to repeal the Affordable Care Act, yesterday their effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act finally in a kind of formal way concluded. It collapsed. It's over now. And there will be the body will continue to twitch a little bit in the months ahead, but because McConnell will talk about trying to do things and there might be a couple like test votes. But the reality is it's over now. For 7 years, the Republican Party made as the centerpiece of its ideological and governing agenda the repeal or replacement of Barack Obama's signature, a domestic achievement, and they have failed. Despite the fact there's a Republican president, or Republicans control the House, or Republicans control the Senate. That is a big, big moment. And although this was not a passion point for Trump,
when normal Americans, and especially Republican voters, think about, like, what does the Republican Party stand for, this is as much as anything substantively what they have stood for 7 years. That's what they campaigned on. That's what they said they would do. Now they have the power to do it, and they cannot do it, have not done it, and now basically have failed at that. So how much change are we getting right now? Trump talks about everything they've gotten done, but in terms of major domestic achievements, there have been none so far, and we're 6 months in, and it's only going to get harder for him, not easier.
So if this is a sports team, because this is a sports-based show, and you brought in a GM, and he didn't turn it around, nothing happened, people would be up in the streets, and they'd say, well, you got to get rid of this guy.
Yeah.
So is this guy McConnell that you have to get rid of? Does Trump have any clout to go to the 3 or 4 or 5 Republican senators who had the courage to say out front, I'm not voting for this thing? Are there repercussions for them? Are there repercussions for McConnell? Or is it just that people will look at Donald Trump and say, it's a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing?
Well, there are two separate questions there. One is the kind of repercussions question, right? No one in the world will blame Mitch McConnell for this, although, I mean, it is a failure on his part. But look, the reality is, the reason that I've said since the day the Affordable Care Act was passed that it would probably never be repealed is that it's really hard once you have done an entitlement, once you've enacted entitlement. It's hard, really hard to do it. Took forever to get to something that was near universal health care. Once you've extended a big benefit to many, many millions of Americans, it's really hard to take that away from them. And it's hard.
Yeah, you can nibble around the edges, yes, but you're not taking it down.
But taking it away. There's only been one entitlement ever taken away, federal entitlement taken away, which was welfare, AFDC, in 1996 when the Republicans repealed welfare. And the reason was that it affected basically poor black people. And so white people in America were okay with taking away that entitlement. But it was not, there's not been anything else like that. You know, everything else, Social Security, Medicare, these big
entitlements. And by the way, governments are trying to continue to do that, to take away from the poorer people in the country.
Correct. So it's really hard to do this. So people might say McConnell screwed up the maneuvering. I think that he didn't, he should have done this. He should have made the process different. I think in the end that the forces that make it hard to repeal an entitlement would have defeated anybody as Senate Majority Leader. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of repercussions for him.
Okay.
The administration is now threatening these supposedly Trump's now calling some of these Republican senators who've turned against him disloyal, and some of them are up for re-election in 2018. And there's discussion among the Trump outside political people about trying to find primary opponents to take on those people. So they may or may not have an additional challenge, at least, if not maybe suffering the actual ultimate retribution of losing their jobs. So there's that. But I think the bigger question is, you know, everybody talks now about the Trump base, right? What is these people who would walk across broken glass or through a burning building for Donald Trump? There are people like that, many, many millions of them in America. It's probably something like 25% of the electorate. Trump's approval rating right now is at about 36, between 36 and 38, 39%. So there's about 10 points where he could fall before you get to the hardcore base that'll never abandon him ever, 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 right? Those people, a lot of those people, are people who voted for Barack Obama twice and then voted for Donald Trump and yes, are just hungry for change. And at some point, that 10%, their patience is going to run out when they look at Washington and see nothing's changed. There's a bunch of Goldman Sachs people doing tax reform now. That's their big idea in the administration. We're going to save ourselves now by doing tax reform. And the tax reform they want to do is going to look like tax reform that benefits a bunch of rich people, fashioned by the Goldman Sachs Treasury Secretary and the Goldman Sachs National Economic Council head. How does that look to a steel worker in Altoona, Pennsylvania? You know, does that look like change? Well, I think a steel worker
in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
I don't know if they actually do steel work in Altoona, but somewhere in Pennsylvania.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. But if people like that see jobs coming back into America,
yes,
if they can credit Donald Trump with reversing a trend and bringing jobs back so that their own personal welfare is better than it has been, if they voted for Donald Trump in the first place, who's a billionaire, right, they're not going to care if rich people get richer. Right. They're going to care if they get richer.
Yes, I agree. But there are two things, right? One thing is he said, I'm going to come to Washington, I'm going to drain the swamp.
Yeah.
you know, the swamp, we still have gridlock, we're not passing legislation, and it looks a lot in Washington, although Trump looks like nothing we've ever seen in Washington. If you're sitting out in middle America and looking at the overall picture of Washington, dysfunction, nothing going on, Republicans are in control and they can't pass anything, Trump's always in trouble.
And this has nothing to do with Russia.
It has nothing to do with Russia. How is that? How does that look like the kind of change we voted for? Look, they were frustrated. Clinton promised them change. They were frustrated that Clinton didn't give them change. Bush promised change. They were frustrated with Bush. Obama, everybody's frustrated.
Nothing changed.
But here's the thing. This goes to your point, which is right now we have close to full employment. It's not really about jobs coming back. What it is about wages and incomes in this country, which have been flat, stagnant for average Americans for 25 years. If Donald Trump changes that.
Yes, big deal.
If Donald Trump changes that. That will, none of the rest of this will matter.
That's
if average people start to see their wages and incomes going up. But if they look up at the end of 4 years, or maybe a little sooner than that, and they look up and they see, nothing's really changing for me. I mean, I was employed before, but my job was crappy. Or I maybe have two jobs, and my wife has three jobs, and we're working, you know, 75 hours a week. Yeah, you're a little bit better paid than minimum wage.
Yes.
But
not here. We're losing money. Well,
yes. I'm glad to be part of this enterprise, at least for a day. I think that that's a problem. And you know, the combination of if my prospects aren't improving and it doesn't look like anything's changing, that's when you suddenly see that you're down to the hardcore Trump base. And when you're at 25, and presidents have been at 20, George W. Bush ended his time in office at about 17, right? So it's not unheard of to drop down to 25. When you're at 25, you have no power. In Washington, D.C., you have no power to threaten anyone. You have no power to coerce anyone. You have no power to bribe anyone because most of the people you're talking to are more popular than you are if you're the president at 25. Even if you're the president at 35, you're in trouble in terms of that kind of muscular ability to get to use your leverage. What leverage do you have if you're at 35? Not much. But at 25, you have none.
And I'm assuming this we'll get you out on this. I'm assuming that the Bob Mueller investigation, pretty much all it can do is take away even more of that.
It's not, it does look, I mean, is there a light at the end of the tunnel, at some point, full exoneration, you know, but in the intervening period, we're looking at least a year of investigation in which, and again, given what's happened so far, the and again, we could go into weeks, but we don't have time to talk about the totality of this, but every day, the administration looks like they're the most incompetent crisis managers in the world. They lie. They're lying constantly about the Donald Trump Jr. thing. Again, whether there's anything there or not, how can it be that there are now eight people in that room and Donald Trump Jr. and all of the people who've gone on television to say what they've said about this have just told a succession of falsehoods about it? There's nothing about the general way in which the White House is behaving or the facts of the story that suggest this is going to get better before it gets worse.
That's what I would say. Because now you have the alarming headline today is second meeting with Putin.
Yes.
Now, what a reasonable person could do is step back and say, well, they were at this conference together, and they both have nuclear weapons, and there's been a lot of talk about them. And wouldn't it actually be better if we were somehow on better terms with Russia? Well, of course that all would be true. And how do you do that? Well, you schmooze somebody.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do for a living. And now it's turned into something
But here's what you don't do. You don't hide it from the press. You don't, like, pretend like it never happened, right? You don't, like, you don't let it have to be. If Trump had done, if they'd done a readout in Russia and stood up and said, you know what? Donald Trump actually sat at dinner tonight with Vladimir Putin. He had another hour with Putin. And if they brought the American translator and done things the way you normally do them,
wouldn't that be good?
People would have said, well, why is Trump? I mean, he's been so favorable to Putin. Why? There would have been questions. But when you lie about
it,
you appear to be hiding it. And you don't bring the only person with the two of them is the Russian translator. It makes it seem just really, really weird. And again, given the history of the fact that Trump has just been in this bromance with Vladimir Putin now for 2 years, won't say anything bad about the guy ever, and there are all these dark clouds.
Even though Nikki Haley is ripping this guy on the world stage.
But it is literally one of the craziest things I've ever seen. Because if Barack Obama did this, it would have been a big deal. People would have said, Obama had a private secret meeting with Putin and didn't bring a translator, and there was no American in the room, and it's lost to history.
Okay.
People would have been critical of that. But it's Trump in the middle of a Russia investigation.
Barack Obama would not have done it.
Well, of course not.
Because he understood the science of politics.
No president in our lifetime would have done this.
No.
In the whole history of the country.
But again, the guy runs on, I'm the agent of change.
Yes. But, you know,
I'm a businessman.
Yes. But
modern presidential.
Yes.
It's different. All right. This is good. But, you know, we can't go on for hours because I'm tired. I'm old. We'll take a break. We'll come back with jingles and email, yes?
That's right.
I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
There was a time back when the season started. Bryce Harper's ring seemed to be in sight. Now I'm feeling burned, yeah. With leads that can't be guarded, bullpen's a mess almost every night. Now listen, all they want is to get some batters out. If he's in the tank, these guys stink, and it makes me wanna shout. And when Tronin starts pitching, you know Tone will be bitching. Make this guy leave the country. Yeah, when Tronin is pitching, it's a ball.
It's a great, great vocal by Joe Arrow, obviously. That's an Aerosmith song. Elliot Olshansky sends it in, even what appears to be a lost season for my beloved Mets. Listening to you kvetch about the Nationals' bullpen woes continues to entertain, so I figure the least I could do is entertain you in return with the help of Joe Arrow. Maybe a little too intense for Walker, but please tell Michael that Rockabye Baby has a lovely album of lullaby covers of Aerosmith songs. Congratulations on the induction to the Wall of Fame. So that's really nice. Elliot Olshansky in Comac. On Long Island, Suffolk County. Before we get to the mailbag, I want to say thank you to John Hylam and also to Steve Sands of La Cheeserie and the Golf Channel for coming on the show today. I'd like to thank the sponsors, Casper Mattresses and Policy Genius. Please support them the way they support our podcast. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. And if you listen to the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. I have two long notes here about Federer and Nadal. One from John Hayes in Spokane, Washington. I think one of the most overlooked aspects of Federer v. Nadal is the number of times during Federer's prime where Nadal got knocked out of tournaments such as Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the Aussie Open early before Federer even had the opportunity to play him. That deprived Federer from possibly getting additional victories over Nadal on Federer's strongest courts, whereas Federer for years was perhaps the second-best clay court player, which allowed Nadal multiple opportunities to defeat Federer in the French Open. If Federer got him knocked out early in the French Open appearances and therefore hadn't suffered those losses to Nadal, does that make him the better player because he did not suffer those defeats and their record against each other is closer? It's an interesting point. Why should Federer be penalized for being during his career the second best clay court player to what I would say is undisputably the best clay court player of all time?
Yeah, we discussed that.
Yeah. Stretton Irwin from Seattle. This is John Hayes from Spokane. A lot of tennis fans, yeah, I guess, in the state of Washington. After hearing the discussion about Federer and Nadal, I felt compelled to write to inform you of some facts that weren't uncovered by your crack squad of investigators.
Took him a second.
Nadal never made it to far enough in the U.S. Open to face Roger in five consecutive U.S. Open championships. They never played head-to-head at the U.S. Open, where Federer has 40 consecutive wins at one time. There are more clay tournaments per year than grass. Federer in his prime won a record 65 consecutive matches on grass. Federer could be argued as the third or fourth best clay court player of all time, but Nadal's clearly the best of all. So they're making the same case. The case is for Federer that it's just bad luck.
Yes.
And Nadal, he didn't pile up victories against Nadal on other surfaces.
You're huge with tennis fans in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, more importantly, from Ron Vavruska Jr., listening to the podcast, I heard about your Japanese maple. My neighbor had one in his front yard that he also had to take down this year, suffering from the same symptoms. As far as I know, the tree was at least 21 years old. This tree is at least 40 years old. Also, I had a weeping cherry tree that was 20 years old. It inexplicably died this year. I just took it down this week. I live in Mount Pleasant. I hope if you find out what happened, you'll cover it on your show. I will. I need an arborist.
Yes, you do.
Craig Kilgo, best tree removal guy. He will give you the lowest price guaranteed, and he gives me a number of a tree removal guy. And he says, you'll have to get someone else to plant the new one, but you should never use an arborist to remove a tree. I don't think I have to tell you that. Actually, you do.
Yeah.
I thought it was all-encompassing.
I just thought arborists took care of trees.
Tree removal guy sounds...
Bobby Gottfried, like as you know, I'm not an arborist, but I can highly recommend Bill Eck from Bartlett Trees. He did some work for me on a project recently. I thought he was great. And Carol Archibald, Bartlett Tree Experts. Very, very, very good.
Well, that's nice.
So
I guess I'll call them.
Yeah, you've got some needs.
I guess I'll call Bartlett. Derek Lipson is a colonel in the United States Army Special Forces in Abilene, Kansas. three chickens walking on the side of the road. You almost stopped the car. What, did they need a ride to KFC? Have you ever driven and seen, in the places you've lived in big cities, have you ever seen chickens walking on the side of the road?
Sure.
Route 16 in Delaware, chickens on the side. I've never seen it before.
London a lot. We get
chickens.
That.
Yeah, not chickens
not,
in a pen.
Not in the city. I mean, I've not seen chickens, but you know, I'm covering campaigns, you travel around a lot outside yes. big cities, and you occasionally see chickens.
Cows.
I see a lot of things by the size.
Been
of the
to
road.
Iowa, I'm sure.
Many times.
Chickens
Monkeys,
in Iowa.
Many times.
Gibbons.
How many states in America have you been to, Tony?
I have not been to all of them. Yeah. I have not been to Alaska and Hawaii, nor will I. But in continental United States, I've not been to Maine. I've not been to Montana. I've not been to either the Dakotas or Idaho.
Alaska's the only one on my list. Why do you say we will not? Why would you?
I don't like to fly.
Okay, so
I can't walk there.
So you're basically saying like Hawaii. Well, you can't walk to Montana either.
No, I mean, I can drive to Montana.
But so you're saying like Hawaii is just out for you.
I think it's out for me.
When you say you don't like to fly, you mean you are petrified of flying?
Yes. Right. I would like to go to Italy. That's not a state.
Yeah, you're going to have to fly there.
I know.
Well, you can take a boat.
It's. Yeah. I'm afraid of boats.
You're worth with
yeah. boats. I have separation from land anxiety. I'm just not good at it.
Well, Italy's
I'm bad at bridges.
Italy's going to be hard for you.
I know.
How are you on the Bay Bridge?
Bad. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
May the Lord have mercy on me.
Hit it, Beeson.
Finish strong.
And my piano.
It's what you do it right here. then I'll shine bright like a star in the sky. Silk and satin, ooh, baby, that's nice. Boop, boop, be doo. But when I wanna feel sparkles, there's just one thing that I need. Anytime's perfect, pour a glass of bubbles for me. Splash in the tub with my bubbles, out with my BFF double bubble. Life's a mess, cauldron bubble. Sunny afternoon, blowing bubbles. When I wanna feel sparkles, there's just one thing that I need. Anytime's perfect, pour a glass of bubbles for me. Life's a mess, cauldron bubble. Sunny afternoon, blowing bubbles. When I wanna feel sparkles, there's just one thing that I need. Anytime's perfect for a glass of bubbles.